The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I was actually thinking as we walked in here, it would be strange to be lighting these six candles, which we wanted to light sort of at the end of Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. But it would have been strange to light them after the day had ended, so I'm glad that you had the foresight to go ahead. It's a very difficult thing that we find ourselves in, this situation, this war. And it's very challenging that in the shadow of the lights of these six candles, that on a certain level we're still dealing with the same issues. I don't know how many of you heard the news, and maybe really as an introduction to what we're going to talk about, although I think also it's important to take a few moments to speak about these issues, and at the end, I'll be glad to open up the floor to questions. 15 soldiers, and I haven't had a chance to catch all the details because I was on the run all day, but 15 soldiers today in Jenin were killed in an ambush. For those of us who know how these things work, it was a matter of time. And you need to understand what that means. First of all, these 15 soldiers, Chayilei Tzal, Israeli soldiers, were reservists, which in the news is a word, but in reality means that most probably all of them had families. So 15 sets of children tonight became orphans. 15 wives received phone calls and delegations. 15 funerals tonight, tomorrow. And most probably, unfortunately, as much as we try and pray, it will get worse before it gets better. I was giving a lecture in Florida. And, you know, talking about the challenge, on the one hand, terror is terror, and you have to fight terror. You know, everybody wants peace. We dream of peace. But you need a partner for peace. And so if, unfortunately, the only choice is war, then a war has to be fought. You can't negotiate in a war. And so somebody in the audience said, you know, I don't understand why you're being so lenient and so soft. Why don't you say it like it is? We have to go in and we have to crush them. We have to destroy them. You know, that's not usually the terminology that I like to use, although I understand what the fellow was saying. But I guess the reason that it challenges me is because it's very easy to sit in an armchair in America and to talk about the need for war. It's very challenging to understand the price for that war. And I'll give you just by way of understanding. Sometimes when you look at a big picture, you lose sight of the details. You know, I remember once I was in an art museum. And what do I know? I took a couple of art history courses, you know, like most of us did in college. And I was looking at a Renoir. And I always like to try to catch the tour guides when you go to an art museum. Because there's always someone leading some tour who obviously has a lot of knowledge. And you can learn a lot. And this particular fellow actually stopped with a tour of like 15 people in front of this Renoir. And he made them stand back and look at the picture. And of course everybody's oohing and aahing because they're all in the middle of whatever art history course they're taking. And then he said, now step up really close. What do you see? And I had never really thought to do that. You don't want to step right up to a picture, but that's what he did. So I joined this group, you know, and you stand this close to a picture. And he said, now look at the hair. You can't see this on a reproduction or in a magazine. But if you look at a real Renoir, what's amazing, this fellow is saying about the Renoir, is that he actually draws each individual hair. His hand was so practiced, and he had developed such a skill that he didn't draw broad strokes of hair, he actually drew each individual hair. It's amazing. And when you step really close and you see a detail, and then you step back and you look at the picture, you realize the painting takes on a whole different meaning. It's not just a beautiful scene. It's an enormous statement of effort and discipline and training and focus and will. And the picture changes. And your appreciation of the picture changes. So I'll give you an example. People people talk about going into Ramallah. I remember we were in Beirut. They had to take a certain area beyond the stadium. And we did this about 7 times. You took it, they moved in. You took it, they moved in. And I remember there was one building. I was just telling a couple people in the car. I think it was a 6 or 7 story building. And we had a pluga, which, you know, in my unit was 35 guys. And it took 35 men. I mean, you have to understand, you go into a building, you don't have a blueprint, because nobody's given out blueprints of Beirut. So you have to take it floor by floor. And the way it works, when you take a building, you can never leave a pocket of the enemy behind you. Right? That's standard military doctrine. So if you're taking area, you have to make sure that all the areas in the pockets behind you, that they're covered as well. Because if you're up on the third floor and some terrorist escaped your scrutiny and he's on the second floor, he can do an enormous amount of damage. So you have to cover the approach up to the top floor, and then you have to go floor by floor, and you have to drop men to make sure nobody sneaks in there. And this is exhaustive. And you have to make sure that the different units working in different rooms on a particular floor, different apartments, that they don't end up firing at each other. And you have to be sure, you know, that there aren't any civilians in there. So, you know, you do a lot of yelling to see if anybody's there, and then you throw in smoke to see if anybody yells, and then you throw in a stun grenade to see if anybody yells. Only then do you throw in a grenade, and then you have to go in just to make sure you're safe and they're safe. It's an enormously exhaustive process. Right? I remember we got to the 6th floor, and in the whole building, we didn't see anybody there. It was eerie. It was like they saw the Israeli army coming. There they are. And there were people's belongings. I remember we went into one apartment, and there was mamash like pieces of dinner on the table. Like they'd obviously seen us coming, and they ran. Nobody wants to be there when an army takes a building. And we get to the 6th floor, and, you know, we burst down the door, and there was a Druze fighter who was actually there and had thrown down his gun, and he threw up his hands in the air, and we nearly killed him. Because the shock of seeing another person, it took us almost 7 hours to take one building. Think about that. Next time you look at an aerial map of Ramallah, or Shechem, or Jenin, or Hebron, or Aza, or Rafiah, the list is endless. So this is not a simple procedure. And I'm not talking about the politics of it now. And on the one hand, you know, numbers, the number 6 million, it's not accidental that we have a day to commemorate this particular event. And it's an interesting question, what makes the Holocaust different? And people think what makes the Holocaust different is the number. But that's not really true. There are other events in Jewish history that were as cataclysmic numerically. People think what makes it different is that a civilized nation was devoted to systematically destroying another people. And it's an interesting question, which we'll get to, why were the Nazis so focused on the Jewish people? But when you step back from the numbers and you appreciate the detail, you know, I don't know if anybody's here has ever visited the camps, Auschwitz, Birkenau. It's very important for every Jew to visit these camps while there are still survivors to tell us about it. It's a dream that I have, Bezrat Hashem, to take a group of Israelite students to Poland on the way to Israel, from darkness into light, Bezrat Hashem. Let me know if you're interested this summer. And you go to Birkenau, and you see a shed, and it's filled with children's shoes. It's too mind-boggling to comprehend 1.5 million children. So they tell you to look at one shoe. Now I have, Baruch Hashem, 4 children. And the eldest, Mayan, is 12 years old, Menara. And I imagine when she was born, how much love came into the world from nowhere when she was born. In fact, I remember when we were about to have our second, Yonatan, Dorit and I were having this ridiculous discussion. We were talking about how are we going to love this second child? Because we have so much love for our first child. So where is there going to be room for more love for the second child? And I've since discovered that lots of married couples have this discussion in between their first child and their second child. And you take a step back and, of course, it's a ridiculous discussion. But it's not really a ridiculous discussion because it's a very good question. You devote everything to this child. So how can you find more everything? But, of course, love has no limits. And love doesn't come because you give it. Love comes because there's someone to give it to, or something to give it to, or something in your life worth giving it to, which is why it's so important to find those things. And she was the first child, so 6 uncles and aunts, and first grandchild on both sides, first great-grandchild. All of that love, uncles and cousins and aunts, everybody, focused on this one child. All of that incredible love, one shoe. And then you try to imagine 1.5 million shoes. It's beyond comprehension. to go to Israel, to Yad Vashem, there's a memorial to the children. I don't know if you've been to it. If you haven't, you should go. It is so important to visit Israel now. That's another discussion. And you walk into this dark room. There are a few pictures of children. And then you walk into a darker area, and it's all candles. And it looks like thousands upon thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of little candles. And there's a voice calling out names. Yanosh Dobrin, 11. Rachel Damyenkin, 9. Endless names. Child after child, world after world. And I remember once I went there with someone who worked at Yad Vashem and discovered that all of those little points of light, hundreds of thousands of points of light, are all cleverly created by mirrors reflecting off 6 candles. And you begin to realize that's the implication of a child. How many different lights? All of us in this room could have come from one child a couple hundred years ago. It's mind-boggling. So you take a step back, and the question that has to beat in your breast, although you know it's futile to ask this question, is why? Why? Why do we have this struggle? And I want you to understand, you know, God forbid, the Jewish people do not have a copyright on pain and suffering. Many peoples have suffered many things, but I was born Jewish, so I'm speaking through Jewish lenses. That's why. And I want to understand this. And I want you to know, it could be that some of you will not be talking to me by the end of the evening, because I'm challenged with whether or not Judaism suggests that we're actually supposed to grapple, not just with a response, but maybe even with a reason. Anybody here who's ever met me or known me, I remember once I was teaching in Pittsburgh about 11 years ago, and I was teaching a group of girls, you know, I had different classes, and I had a group of 12th grade girls, and we were studying Jewish philosophy, understanding, you know, the Bible, mitzvot, and one of the girls came to me very upset, because she had been in a class with another rabbi, one of the local kollels, and this rabbi had said something which actually amazed me. It was amazing to me that somebody would say this to a 12th grade student audience. And his contention was that the reason for the Holocaust was the breakdown of religion, the reform movement, rising not coincidentally in Germany. And she was very upset by this, rightfully so. And putting aside the issue for the moment of how an individual concludes to be able to understand God's plan, much less God's pain, is it so easy to say that that's off? And is that a very challenging thought? And although instinctively you know that that can't be, the question is, how do you understand this? And I want to explain to you where I'm going with this. Because there are two different issues here. And we'll come back to this. You know, some of you may get the Parsha email that we send out every week. If you didn't get it, plug, 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 you can send an email. I'll be glad to send it to you. Aaron, high priest, pinnacle of the Jewish experience, dedication of a tabernacle. The Jewish people, after the sin of the golden calf, have been basically silent before God and limited by having no relationship with God for the better part of a year. And finally, as it were, God returns. And the relationship, so brutally ripped apart by the sin of the golden calf, not 6 weeks after the Ten Commandments, begins to be rebuilt. And it's an amazing moment. It's the first instance of the dedication of a sanctuary, in this case the Mishkan, the tabernacle, predecessor to the Beit HaMikdash. It's the first time a sacrifice was ever offered by the Jewish people. It's the introduction of the concept of priesthood of Kohanim, who are meant to spread peace among the Jewish people. It's the introduction of a high priest, a Kohen Gadol, and all of that implies. And in the midst of all of this, Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, who by the way are leaders of the Jewish people, because in the 24th chapter of Exodus, they actually go up, halfway up Mount Sinai, behind Moses and Joshua, ahead of all of the other elders. They take a strange fire, it doesn't matter for the moment what the story is, they do something they're not meant to do. God somehow, Vateitzei Esh Milifnei Hashem, a fire comes from before God and consumes them on the altar. It's a very difficult moment. Aaron has just lost his sons in the moment of his greatest joy, becoming the high priest of the Jewish people. The moment that should be forgiveness for the sin of the golden calf leaves the Jewish people shocked, in pain, in agony, not even knowing what to say. And Moses comes to Aaron to try to comfort him and says a very difficult thing. For this was it that Hashem said, "Bikrovaya kadesh, I will become holy, sanctified through those close to me. Ve'al pnei kol ha'amei kaved, and I will become respected among the people." Very difficult line. It must be good. The Jewish people learned a good lesson from this because they did something wrong. They were punished. That's the implication of the verse. Aaron seems so stupefied by Moshe's response, "Vayidom Aaron." Aaron is silent. So in terms of what Moshe was saying and what that meant, again, I'll be glad to send you an email. You can ask anybody who's in the know. They can tell you how to do that. But there are two things here that fascinate me. One is that the verse takes the time to say, "Vayidom Aaron." And Aaron was silent. Dumama. When you think about it, when someone is silent, the Torah doesn't have to tell me that he's silent. If there are no words mentioned in the verse, I'll know he didn't say anything. And there are many instances, without belaboring the point, where the Torah very clearly implies that in a conversation someone has nothing to say, and it does not have to say that he was silent. We know he was silent. When Yaakov hears of the brothers finding Joseph's coat, it doesn't say Yaakov was silent. We know Yaakov was silent. He can't be comforted. He was silent. So why does it say Aaron was silent? There's a power to silence. It's almost as if to suggest, perhaps, that there are things in this world that you must be silent. That you have a responsibility to understand that there can be no response but silence. That the audacity, perhaps even the arrogance, to attempt to put words into a response is absurd. Watching your two sons in the midst of your greatest joy, watching the sons and daughters and children of the Jewish people butchered from a world of so much joy and Torah and song and beauty, as was Europe, is something so cataclysmic, so tragic, so challenging, that it's not just that we have nothing to say, it's that our silence must be our response. And yet, if you look at the end of the story, Aaron eventually does find words. And this would all be great, except for the fact that the Torah has a number of discussions suggesting that such cataclysmic events will occur, and it actually explains to me why these things occur. And I'm going to get to this. That's very difficult to understand. The second thing that challenges me about this particular story of Aaron and his sons is the phrase that Moshe chooses, "Bikrovai Ekadesh." Through those close to me, I will become sanctified. There are two challenges here. First of all, it seems to be so true. How often do we feel that particularly those who are so close seem to become the sacrifices? Why are the Jews of Israel suffering so? Why is Jewish blood pouring in the streets of Yerushalayim, Netanya, and now Jenin? Haven't we given enough? Hasn't the sacrifice been enough? I mean, don't you feel like crying out? You know, they say we should say Psalms. We should say Tehillim for what's going on in Israel. We should pray. And that's all true. But don't you feel like saying enough? The Jewish people have given enough! Why is it that now when we've come home to the land of Israel, when we're struggling, what's going on? And what can that mean, Bekrovai Ekadesh? Ekadesh means, Moses is suggesting that God is saying, Bekrovai, through those close to me, to God, Ekadesh, I will become sanctified. What do you mean God will become sanctified? How could God become sanctified? First of all, if God becomes sanctified, that means that there's a moment in time, previous to that, that God is less sanctified. And since God is endless, Hashem is endless, Hashem is allness, loneliness and oneness all wrapped up into one. How can Hashem not be anything? How can Hashem become anything? And if already I could pick a verb that would not need to apply to God in terms of improvement,
growth or development, it would be sanctity, kedusha. I always understood that the meaning of kedusha, of sanctity, is developing a relationship with God. Something becomes holy because it's a vehicle for a relationship with Hashem, with God. That's how marriage can be holy. That's how anything in this world can be holy. That's how a 3-pound hamburger can be holy. If you use it in part of your relationship with God and it elevates you, which I think it should, so you become holy, great. Anything in this world can be holy because it can bring you closer to God. But how does God get closer to God? That's ridiculous. So what does that mean? How do I deal with this? Why is it that those who seem so close are suffering so? And what does the Torah, what does Judaism have to say about this? And I want you to know, just so you understand, and because of what's going on in Israel, I'm not going to let this go as long as usual because you've been waiting late, because I also want to get a chance to talk about this and to hear questions about what's going on in Israel, maybe even to give you a little bit of an update. But I want you to know, I was thinking about this all Shabbos, because there's a particular issue that I feel like I've ignored, because it was convenient to ignore it, because it sounds right to sort of sidestep it, and yet it's there. And how do you respond to that? And I want you to understand, it's not enough just to raise this as an issue. We need to make this personal. I want you to know what's going on in the world today has to be personal. It can't be just a number. You know, people hear that a bomb went off, and the first question is, how many people were killed? As if the number defines the event. And we forget how many different events are occurring even before you get to that question. How much deeper does it mean parents will have to deal with their fear if their children are going out of town? How many families will spend how many hours desperately searching for their kids or their loved ones or their parents or their relatives until they find out they're safe? How many habits will become changed all over again? And of course, how many wounded? And by the way, there are so many wounded that you don't know are wounded. My aunt was walking down the street, walking down actually near Yafo Street, not long ago, a few months ago, when one of the bombs went off, right off Ben Yehuda. And she actually saw the bomb. And she's still struggling. She's still scared to walk into town. She was never scared of anything in her life, this woman. It was the final piece and just shocked her. And that doesn't get listed in the paper. And I want to read you one email that I got. Because if you remember nothing, and the question, and the Torah, and whatever we share, but you remember this story, then it will have been worth your coming. I got this letter. My wife forwarded this letter to me. I must have read this like 15 times. This is written by a woman, Jeanette Landau, who lives in Ginat Shomron, not long ago. She's an English woman, came with her family. They made Aliyah, suburbanites. They live just outside of London. And they wanted to live somewhere that wasn't quite in the dense hustle and bustle of the city. So they came across Ginat Shomron. This is before everything went haywire a year and a half ago, because the views there are incredible, and the mountains are green, and you're not that far from the sea. And it's a beautiful place to live. And it's similar. I've been there. It's similar to a flat where I live. Children can run freely in the streets. You can send your 7-year-old son to the grocery store to pick up the groceries, or your daughter, the same age, to go to the doctor to get a prescription. You don't think of these things, because it's an amazing place to live. Back in September 2000, she writes, when the recent intifada started, my outlook on life began to change. All of a sudden, I would be driving home, and after the initial shock of hearing shooting to my side as I would pass by Kalkilia, I got over it. It became a part of my life. I accepted it, the same as I would having to stop at a red light or sitting in line of traffic. And then the pogrom, the shootings and the bombings, became more and more frequent. And the news would reveal the latest family or families torn apart by their individual tragedies of losing a family member. And it was still distant, but again it became part of our daily lives. And then tanks started appearing in the vicinity of Kalkilia and some of the neighboring villages. Many soldiers around. Things that don't really fit into the life of a suburban Londoner. Yet here it was. And again, it was something that I accepted, as in any other routine. And the shootings and the bombings continued. And no longer were they things that happened to other people. It was getting closer and closer to home. It was already close enough in that the victims were family members or friends or neighbors, and then even neighbors themselves. And I began to realize that it would just be a matter of time. And that's when I would start to imagine, what would it feel if it happened to me? And all sorts of images would go through my head. But my biggest worry was that, God forbid, I would be shot dead by some passing Arabs, and then my children would be left without a mother. And how would they survive? I want you to know this is such a challenge. People don't understand the impact that this has had on people's thought processes. You know, we came this year to America, some of you know, and we got to Boca. And about, a few weeks after we were in Boca, so we decided to go out to exploring. So we put all the kids in the car, and we went back into town there just to get a cup of coffee, some ice cream. And all of a sudden, Dorit and I realized this was the first time in over a year that we had taken our children out at night. Not because I lived in fear, but because you think, like, why take the children out at night? Why take a risk? People in a flat, when they get into a car and they, you know, want to go to town, they think, should we go in the same car or should we split up? Like parents who don't want to take an airplane together. And finally, about halfway through the year last year, after my, fourth stint of reserve duty, so we decided that we have to be responsible parents. It's actually a law in Israel that if you don't write a will determining who will take care of your children, God forbid, in the event, so officially those children become wards of the state. And if your siblings, your parents, your grandparents, if they can't convince the state, then the state is right to decide what happens to your children. And this, by the way, is true apparently in America, I don't know, whatever. So we decided we'll be responsible right away. Who's going to take care of our children? What should happen to those, you know, huge amounts of money that I make in chinuch, right, in Jewish education? But okay. So I went to a friend of mine, he actually laughed about that. He said, this is going to be the easiest will I ever wrote. But he told me an amazing thing. He said that half of his neighbors had already come to him to write a will. Can you imagine? Young sets of parents, with kids who are little, are writing wills. But my imagination took the wrong line. It wasn't me. It was two of my children. Rachel didn't make it, Lior did. But he suffered pain and experiences I can't even fathom. I will never forget the night of the bombing. It was a bad dream come true. Nothing more, nothing less. I knew Rachel was there. I knew she was hurt. But I couldn't find her. It seemed like hours and hours. And all I could think of was that she needed me by her. And yet I didn't even know where she was. And what seemed like a short while before I learned which hospital she was in. And then I discovered that Lior was also there, lying somewhere in the ambulance of the hospital, also needing me. And I couldn't be there. And then Rachel died. Rachel, my only daughter. Rachel, my love. I love her dearly, still do, with a lot of pain, and always will. What do you do with a letter like this? How do you answer the unasked question? And you light six candles. Because over 60 years ago, not a madman, not even a nation, but an entire world decided that Jewish blood was cheap. And I think the reason we so struggle with this is because on a certain level, we still haven't solved that problem. So what do you do with it? So I want to suggest an idea. And the idea is a little bit challenging, and I want you to understand, sometimes we come, we learn together, and you get an opinion, and I have very strong feelings about the opinion. I could be right or I could be wrong. I have to tell you that tonight, I'm really not sure. I'm really still processing this. This is a work in progress. So I want to share this idea with you. Bat it around, and you'll let me know what you think of it. Because I can't tell you that I'm sure, but I can tell you that it's a question we have to struggle with. You know, it's an interesting question. The reason that we light these candles is because we want to guarantee that there will never again be another Holocaust. That's also part of what makes it so challenging this year. You read about what's going on in France, Argentina, Belgium, England, and make no mistake about it, because it's right beneath the surface here in New York City and all over America. And it's a little bit frightening. It's a lot frightening. What guarantees that there won't be another Holocaust? So most people would say, well, the safest guarantee that there won't be another Holocaust is peace. peace will come. It'll all work out. And if you look in Yeshayahu, and I have to apologize because normally I have the time to, didn't quite work out that way, to mark all these pages. Isaiah. Beautiful, beautiful verses. The book of Yeshayahu, in the second chapter, Perek Bet. And it will come in the end of days. The house of God will sit on top of the mountains. And nations will come to see her. Amazing. And many nations will come and say, let us go up to the mountain of God. And let us learn from these ways to become ethical. And Zion shall spew forth, or from Zion shall go forth Torah, Jewish ethics, morality, mitzvot, beauty. V'shafat ben al-goyim. It's such a beautiful vision. Lo yisa goy al goy cheret, v'lo yilmadu ad milchama. A nation shall not lift up sword against nation. But it doesn't seem to be working. Because as try as you might to bring about peace, if peace was the solution, then we should almost be there. Because if ever a people was willing to give up in order to achieve peace, I would say it's safe to say, over the last 7 years, as much as you can expect from a people to do, and as much as you can hope that a people will dream, we dreamed. Doesn't seem to work. So I want to present you with a challenging question. And we've discussed this question before, and I'll tell you what the question is, and I'll tell you how we responded, and then I'll tell you my problem. Okay? There are two conflicting Talmudic statements. In one Talmudic statement it says, Chayi Bani Mizoni, a person's livelihood and a person's, you know, children, your health, everything, Lu Bizchuta Talya Milta Ela B'Mazla. It doesn't depend on merit, it depends on mazel, on luck. So in other words, if somebody's suffering, if somebody's in pain, don't assume they've done something wrong, it's mazel. It's all fate. That's a very challenging thing for a Jewish source to say, for the Talmud to say. Don't assume God has a plan. Assume it's mazel. That's the Talmud in Moed Katan. On the other hand, there are other Talmudic statements. The most obvious, famous, is one in Brachot, on the fifth folio. It says, Yisurin over in Aladam, if a person goes through travail, difficulty, Yipashpesh b'masav, let him leaf through his actions like a book. In other words, if something bad happens to you, figure out what you did wrong. Do you understand this? If I see you in pain, you must have done something wrong. That's a very, very difficult thing to say. And it has some very horrible implications. I mean, I should walk into hospital rooms where people are in tremendous pain. I should go and find these 15 families and say, no, what'd you do wrong? So that's horrible. But that's what the Talmud says. And yet the Talmud doesn't say that. So which of those two sources is correct? Do I assume that if I did something wrong, that if I suffer it's because I did something wrong, or is it all mazel? So we discussed this at some point recently, and I pointed out, by the way, interestingly enough, that we, as a Jewish people, actually rule on this issue every time we go to a wedding, every time we go to a simcha. Because what do? Somebody is in tremendous joy. They've obviously done something right in their life. They've merited to find their beloved, or to have a healthy child. What do? We should say, listen, you, wow, you must be a tzaddik. You must be doing unbelievable things in your life, because look what you merited. But that's not what we say. We say mazel tov. Good mazel. It's nothing to do with you. Don't pat yourself on the back. It's a horrible thing to say, but that's what we say. So which is it? So I want to share with you how Rav Soloveitchik responds to this. And this was just in a parsha email, because precisely this response is what's challenging me with what's going on today. Soloveitchik points out, and I actually first heard this from a good friend of mine, Dr. Baruch Sturman, a friend from Efrat. Fascinating idea. He says, you know, there are two partners to suffering in this world. There is the witness to suffering, and there is the sufferer. Now, when I see someone suffering, my natural inclination is to say, must have done something wrong. You know why? Because if they did something wrong, then I can put them into a nice, neat little box. They're sinning, so they're being punished. As long as I don't do anything wrong, I'll be fine. And my life becomes very simple and very easy. But when I suffer, if I struggle with my struggles, well, then it's not anything I did wrong. It must be mazel. It's all mazel. We can't understand these things, right? That's the natural tendency. Says of Soloveitchik, we have to fight that tendency. When you see someone else in pain, Your job is not to figure out why they're suffering. Your job is to figure out how you can be there for them in their suffering. It's not to lift a hand. It's to extend a hand. And let God work it out. It's a mazel. We can't understand. Different people are given different packages, and we have to struggle with our packages, and what we do with them is up to us. But part of our package is how we help other people with their packages. But when I suffer, I go through difficulty. Judaism, therefore, is discussing not why people suffer, but how to deal with suffering. And that all works very well, and that's my neat little box, challenging as it is, when you're talking about an individual, whether it's yourself or someone else. But how do you deal with this when it's an entire people? How do you deal with the fact that if an Israeli soldier is lying in a gutter in agony in Jenin, then every one of us has to be suffering all together at the same time? That we as a people are challenged. Now, I don't know if you heard yet. The Conference of Presidents announced that there's going to be a rally in Washington, D.C. this Monday. I believe it's at 1. And it is a mitzvah. It is an absolute obligation on every single Jew that hears about this to figure out a way to get to that rally. The mitzvah to go to this rally, in my opinion, and I can't imagine, despite the fact that I hope that there's a wide divergence of opinions on, you know, different issues of what's going on in the world today, and that's good, is not because someone else is in pain. It's because by definition, when one is in pain, we're all in pain. I didn't go to Miami Children's Hospital with my daughter, you know, because she was in pain. I went there because I was in pain. And the most amazing experience was to discover how many other people in your life, and people you never heard of in your life, were in pain. Because one little five-year-old girl was challenged. That was an amazing experience. So if that's true for one five-year-old girl, imagine how that's true for the entire state of Israel. So what do you do with this? Have we done something wrong? Are we missing something? Are we not worthy? And if that's true, then doesn't that mean that those who are responsible for that wrong are responsible for everything that's going on? I mean, can you make that leap? Do you dare? And I want you to know that I can't tell you for how many years anybody who would suggest such a thing, I would think that's terrible. And yet, when you look at the Bible, when you look at the Torah, and we're almost done, the Torah seems to say this very clearly in the fourth chapter of Dvarim. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, listen to this. This is not me. This is not a rabbi from a Lakewood Kollel talking to a group of 12 kids. This is the Bible. Now, you can struggle to understand the Bible, but you can't ignore the Bible. You can disagree with the Bible if you want to. But this is very interesting. What does the verse say? Raki shamer lecha. Now understand, this is Moses standing up on Har Nevo. One of the most tragic moments in the entire Torah. Moshe, who has put up with all of our nonsense for 40 years, who took us out of Egypt, who walked with us in the desert, who listened to our complaints, is told on the edge, on the banks of the Jordan River, on the east bank, that he's never going to get in. And he begs God, and it's the only time God says, no, you're not getting in. But Hashem lets him, God lets him go up on Mount Nebo, Har Nebo, in Jordan, to look out over the land that he dreams of, that he will never see. Can you imagine? I get to do something that Moses didn't get to do. Imagine Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, Charlton Heston, gets a telegram. And the telegram up on Har Nevo says that for $6.99 you can get on an oil plane and you can fly to Israel. But there's some suicide bombers. There'd be a shiloh, you'd have a question. Well, I don't know. I have to check with the State Department. Can you imagine? Moshe does not get into the land of Israel. And he gives a parting speech, a soliloquy, over the last month of his life, most of it in one day, to the Jewish people. And this is part of that. Raki shamer lecha. But be careful. Ushmol nafshecha ma'od. And guard your soul well. Pen tishkach et hadvarim asher ra'u einecha. Lest you forget the things that your eyes saw. Unless they leave your heart, these messages, and the beauty that I have given you. Lest you forget the day that you stood before God, Bechorev, which is a name for Sinai. Be'emor Hashem Elai, when God said to me, Hakeli et ha'am, gather for me the people, Ve'ashmiim et dvarai, Asher yilmedun, that I can tell them my words that they will learn. Ufentisai necha, I'm skipping a few verses, and lest your eyes look to the heavens, Hashamayma, Ve'ra'ita et ha'shemesh ve'te'erech ve'te'kochavim, and you will see the sun, the moon, the stars. Yishtachavit alayim, you'll bow down to them, etc., etc. And the verses go on, Ki tolu banim u'bnei banim, when you will have children and children's children, and you will settle in the land. Vehishchatem, you will become destructive. Vehasitem pesel, you will make idols. And ultimately, a few verses later, vehefitz Hashem etchem ba'amim, and so Hashem will scatter you. God will scatter you among the nations. Vehavatem sham Elohim maseh yedei adam etzva heaven, and you will worship other gods, the products of man, wood, the stone. The Vilna Gaon, one of the great rabbis of the 18th century, suggests that the wood and the stone in this verse are the wood of the cross and the stone of the Dome of the Rock. Alluding to what we will suffer and how we will struggle under the dominion of the Christian Empire and the Muslim conqueror. And in your pain, these things will find you. This pain, this travail, this suffering, everything we've experienced in so many places and in all places for 2,000 years of exile. Until the day will come when Veshavta, when you will return. What's going on? Listen to these words. This is very challenging. It's very good to say we can't understand, because we can't. And it's very realistic to say it's not ours to question and to understand, because maybe that's true. But that's not what the verse says. The verse says, I want to tell you what's going to happen, and I want to tell you why it's going to happen. What do you do with that? So listen to this idea. There's a Mishnah, and we're just about done, and then we'll take some questions. There's a Mishnah teaching in Ethics of the Fathers. It's a very difficult Mishnah. One of the pairs that receives tradition, Shmaya Naftalion, it's in the first chapter of Ethics of the Fathers, says, Chachamim, Hizaru b'divreichem. Scholars, be careful with your words. I was sitting with Mayan, our eldest, getting ready for a bat mitzvah, and we decided for a bat mitzvah we're going to learn Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. I happen to think that it's one of the most important books in Judaism. It's 120 Mishnayot teachings. It's a collection of the greatest rabbis of over 500 years of Jewish history, during pretty much the entire period of the Mishnah, the oral tradition being written down. And basically, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Judah the Prince, collected what he felt were the individual lines, the individual lessons, one-liners, that these greatest rabbis in Jewish history, 500 years worth, had to share about how you become an ethical person. Can you imagine somebody wrote a book and collected 500 years of the greatest multi-billionaires in history and asked them a very simple question, how do you become rich? And put them in a book. Andrew Carnegie, Melton, Rockefeller, Trump, well, Trump, right, whatever. And collected them all, so be a bestseller, because everybody wants to get rich. Pirkei Avos isn't a bestseller, because ethical, well, you know, you want to get rich, ethical. It's an amazing book. And I said to Mayan, the deal is, I'm willing to learn with her, and we're doing these Mishnayot, but the deal is that she has to learn them by heart. There's no value to me whatsoever. We don't have to finish them in time for a bat mitzvah. As long as we started a project, I hope it lasts forever. And we finish all 120, then we'll go back and we'll do them again. Great, hope we start a habit, right? But the deal is she has to learn a Mishnah by heart before I, you know, study it with her so that she'll understand it. So we're going through and she's learning all this Mishnah by heart. It's an amazing thing to realize, and of course if she's learning it by heart, then, well, I have to learn it by heart. It doesn't look good. So it's a good way. It's a good system. Right? Okay. She's a little quicker than I am, but okay. If you've met her, you know what I mean. So there's an amazing Mishnah. Avtalion says, Chachamim, Tizaru b'divreichem. Be careful with your words. Lest through your words you will be obligated to exile. And you'll go into that exile, and people will drink bitter water, and you'll cause death in the world. It's such a strange Mishnah. How do you become an ethical person? Well, judge your fellow man. Well, distance yourself from evil. On three things the world stands. Be careful what you say, lest you go into exile, and people drink bitter water and die. Thank you. So I was sitting there with Mayan, and we decided that there are two questions you have to ask. The first is, what is galut? What is exile? What does it mean you'll be obligated to exile? What is exile? Why does exile come? And the second is, what are chachamim? Who are the teachers? Who are the wise men? So I'll tell you what exile is. The Talmud says that the second temple was destroyed for one very simple and challenging reason. Sinat chinam. Because of hatred that didn't even have a basis. You hate someone else because you don't like them. Now that, by the way, is a very challenging statement that many people mention, but people don't stop to think about that. How could any hatred be chinam? How could it be blind hatred? You hate somebody because you need something. In fact, the story of the Talmud there, somebody gets invited to the wrong party, the rabbis sit and watch while this fellow's embarrassed, he's angry at them because they... There can be no reason for hatred. And therefore, all hatred is sinat chinam. That's the mistake people make. People think there's sinat and then there's sinat chinam. It's not true. All hatred is blind hatred. There's no real reason to hate. There's a real reason to act, but not to hate. Even when you struggle against Palestinian suicide bombers, you don't have to hate. That doesn't do you any good. Hatred among our people caused exile. So somehow, chachamim yizaru b'divreichem, be careful in what you say, lest you bring hatred into the world and cause exile. And that's very interesting. Who are the chachamim? Who are the wise ones? The teachers. So I'll tell you what my aunt's perush was, and I think she's right. I think the chachamim are everybody. Because a chacham, a wise person, is anybody who has students. Any role model, any person anyone looks to, and we don't realize that in everything we do, we affect others. We have an impact. We have the opportunity to sanctify Hashem, and we have the opportunity to desecrate God's name, because deep within each one of us is the image of God, and by virtue of the fact that within each one of us is the image of God, we bring God into the world, or we push God out of the world. It's an amazing thing that Judaism believes that we are given that responsibility and opportunity to bring God into the world, or at least the name of God into the world. And it's when I sanctify, when I bring Hashem into the world, when I bring love into the world, that Hashem comes close to the world. And if we don't do that, then Hashem is distant from the world. It's an amazing perception. You know what I think these psukim are saying, these verses? It's very interesting. I haven't had the chance to check this out, which is why I tell you this is still in process. But it's very interesting that the entire language here is in the singular. V'ra'ita et ha-shemesh. Singular usage, and you individual will see. I'll tell you what our problem is. Everybody talks, and this is the last point, everybody talks about how there isn't enough Jewish unity in the world. Right? But how we're so separate. We need to bring people together. But who of us is willing to take responsibility for it? How many times have you heard people say, we have to learn to work together. We have to create unity. There are whole movements. I just heard of another one. Achdus. Unity. Have you ever heard anyone say, I'm at fault. I'm bringing disunity into the world. Now, if there's so much disunity into the world, then somebody must be responsible for bringing it here. But nobody's taking ownership. So I'll tell you the secret. It's a very difficult secret. And I wonder if it isn't the message here. You know, I hate labels. I hope everybody in this room is challenged by labels. Labels are a very dangerous thing. We label each other, we put each other into boxes. It's a very dangerous thing. But for the purpose of this point, I'll use labels. Do you ever wonder why the Orthodox movement has such a hard time with the Reform movement? Why people who see themselves as so linked with tradition? I see myself as very bound up in tradition. But why do so many people who are bound up with tradition have such a hard time with people who are letting go of tradition? To me, it's a very simple answer. Because where do you think the Reform movement came from? They came from Volozhin, the Yeshivot. They came from Vilna. They came from Heidelberg. They came from all of these places. If we were doing, we here, the Orthodox movement, whatever you want to call it, we're doing such a great job of showing everyone how beautiful Judaism is, then why didn't anybody want to try something different? That's very hard for people to agree to. That's very hard to admit. It's very hard to admit that the real problem is not what everybody else is doing wrong, that the real problem is what I'm doing wrong. Yisurin over in Aladam, Yepashpesh b'masav. When we go through travail, you got to struggle. The issue is not what everybody else is doing wrong. I'm so tired of hearing how we all need to get together. Each of us has to decide, I'm going to make the world a little better. That's the challenge. Bikrovaya Kadesh. I have the power, literally, to bring light into the world. And the Torah never says that any one sector of the Jewish people will struggle or suffer because of the mistakes they make. The Torah says you, individual, in other words, all of you are one. It doesn't say some people will make mistakes and all of you will suffer. It says all of you will make mistakes, because the greatest challenge is to realize that if some of us are making mistakes, all of us are making mistakes. If a Jew can embezzle money and end up on the front page of the New York Times, we are all in a quandary, because we're all doing something wrong. Because as a collective community, we have not created an environment of ethics which would absolutely negate that type of behavior. And if a Jew in one corner of the world spits at another Jew, or a Jew has a problem with another Jew, then all of us need to struggle with that, because we all are doing something off. And every single one of us contributes to it in some small way, including me and you and everybody. That's a big challenge. It's a big challenge to realize that if we are given the land of Israel, it's not just a gift, it's a responsibility, it's a privilege. And I want you to know, I challenge anybody in this room to find anywhere in the Torah or in the Talmud that suggests that when we get the land of Israel for a third time, that we can't lose it again. You will not find such a source. It's difficult even to find such a source when the third temple is rebuilt. And even then it's difficult. But certainly the temple not being built, there's absolutely no guarantee that we will not lose the land of Israel. I want you to understand that. People often function as a community, assuming, because we grew up with the state of Israel. Don't assume it. 60 years ago, Jews assumed a lot of things. Let's not make the same mistake. That's our challenge. We need lepashpesh b'maaseinu. We need to look at the rest of the world as mazel, and to look at ourselves and figure out what we need to fix. And that's the part of the question that no one can answer for us, but us. And I want to end with one thing. What's going on in Israel right now is very challenging on so many different levels. And I think it's a mitzvah. It's incumbent on all of us to figure out what we can do. There is nothing more challenging in all the world as being alone. Statistically speaking, there may be some people in this room who understand that better. But all of us need to understand that. The only time in the entire Torah it says something is not good, lo tov hayot adam levado. It's not good to be alone. We cannot allow the people of Israel to feel that they are alone. We have a responsibility to let them know that we're with them. And there are a lot of different ways to do that. And I want you to understand something. Never in the history of the Jewish people has there been a community as powerful, as wealthy, as influential in a country which was so powerful and influential in the world as the Jewish community of America in this generation. Never. I challenge you. Never. Mordechai comes to Esther in the story of Purim. And Esther's in the palace. And Mordechai understands that Haman has decreed that all the Jews will die. And Mordechai says to Esther, "Mi yodea in ka'eta zot," who knows, but for this moment, you've been put in the palace. "V'im ka'eta harishi," and if you will be silent now, "revach v'atzalat avol yudin makom acher," then the Jewish people's salvation will come from another place. Now that line makes absolutely no sense. It's ridiculous. To hear me say, Mordechai, sitting outside of the palace, is telling Esther, the queen, if you don't save the Jewish people, somebody else will. That's all he should say. He obviously missed Dale Carnegie. What he should say is, listen, if you don't do this, it's all over. We're going to be destroyed. He says, if you don't do this, somebody else will. In other words, don't make the mistake of thinking that you hold God's plan in your hands. I want you to understand, the issue here is not whether the state of Israel will fall. The issue is not whether the Jewish people will eventually get home and whether we'll build the Beit HaMikdash and everything else, and peace will just spew itself out over the world. That's not the issue. God says that one day we'll go home. We'll go home. Some of us will go home screaming and kicking, and some of us will go dancing, but we'll all get home. Whether we as individuals are on those boats, that's a different question. The issue here is not only about Israel. The issue is about our souls as a community here. Mordechai says to Esther, so God will choose someone else, but this is what you're here for. This is why God put you in this world. It's why God put you in the palace. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? Because this is the question that you will have to answer. This is our moment And I struggle with this. I have an identity crisis. I consider myself an Israeli, but I'm in America right now. It's very challenging. So right now, we're here. And this is the moment of the American Jewish community. And the question is, will the American Jewish community, including every single person sitting in this room, rise to the occasion? It's a huge challenge. And there's a lot to do. So I want to tell you three things. First of all, I want you to know, I can't tell you how challenging this is to me, and then I'll take any questions you want, about anything you want, about Israel or anything else. I can't tell you how challenging it is to me personally, how many Jews there are, who are educated on many topics, who are missing so many basic facts regarding Israel, the Middle East, the current conflict. It's mind-boggling to me. And the list is endless, and it's not so difficult to discover these things. So that's the first thing. You know, the first thing is to become knowledgeable. I'll give you an example. I hear all the time on the news, you know, Yasser Arafat is a terrorist. Can we deal with Yasser Arafat? What's the response you always hear on the news? What do you always hear them say? Should we get rid of Arafat? Well, who else would you talk to? Have you heard that on the news? Does that drive you nuts? Who else would you talk to? Did America talk to Adolf Hitler in 1944?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.